So you could lay that wire inside the coax cable, have it off to one side. Will that make good coax? Yes. Will it be 50 ohms? Maybe it's going to be 35 ohms. And even if on certain positions along that length of homemade coaxial cable, the semiconductor sometimes loops itself up so that it's centerized for a couple of feet and then goes back down so it's non-centerized, that section where the impedance changes because the semiconductor is moving in its position, as long as that section is short in wavelength, so it's not doing it for 50 feet, so to speak, at 432 megacycles. If it's doing it for
repeater, timeout, repeater.
So if your frequency is low enough, it can work like a charm. That homemade coax you just described, you're absolutely not going to use it on 432, and you're probably not going to get away with it on 2 meters. You probably would get away with it on 80 meters, because as you disturb the way the wire is waving around inside of that piece of tubing, as long as it waves around for distances that are short in wavelength, it all averages out. You could study each one of those sections by cascading the use of your Smith chart, so to speak, and you could figure out what the overall impedance is doing. So can you make that work? Absolutely. How well is it going to work? A hell of a lot better than in dollars per performance. You're going to get a lot of performance out of it as long as your frequency is low enough. And if you want to start making it better and better, well, you pull the center conductor real tight between the two ends so it's nice and straight and not wiggling in the middle. You either do or don't support it with little discs. There's ways you can make your homebrew coax better and better. But if you just laid it in there any old way and your frequency is low enough, it's going to work like a charm. It's going to have some more loss than the commercially made coax, because as that center conductor with its outer rubber sheathing, so to speak, is laying on the bottom of the outer cylindrical aluminum tube, it's got a rather short distance. You're putting a fairly strong E-field across that rubber, and the rubber is a little bit lower in performance, a little higher in loss per foot than the real polyethylene or foam polyethylene would be. But still, again, at low enough frequencies, it's going to work like a charm. It would be a very interesting experiment to try it with and without tugging real tight on that semiconductor between the two ends, measuring the insertion loss, measuring the impedance, measuring the velocity factor. As silly as that sounds, that could be a senior project in electrical engineering, a bachelor degree school, if you know what I mean, Mel. K2KEY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
Question.
Mel first, and then we'll pick up the question. K2KEY? I bet you're surprised by that one, Mel. K2RIW.
No, I figured if you, I could say on 80 meters or something, literally you could use coax cable that was not really worthless stuff on the VHF UHF band. Worthless old coax, and he went down to 80 meters or something. I would bet many places, many times it worked perfect. So you gave the coax to somebody and he used it and said, I don't know what was wrong with you, but you gave me perfectly good coax, even though maybe it looked kind of crummy on the outside. So, all right, if you took this pipe and say it's, what is it, a half-inch conduit inside diameter would be, what, a little less, I don't know, whatever it is. And I put in a piece of wire, insulated wire of some sort, so that it somewhat centered up, kept the single wire in the pipe somewhat centered up some way. I would bet you most likely would have some possibility of some really excellent coax for, especially for HF work, over.
Comment, Dick?
Absolutely. We've got a question and also John's comment. If you really did pull it tight between the two ends, and now you've got air-filled coax cable, that's the lowest loss you're going to get, with rubber covering or enamel covering, I'm a little worried about the enamel and Sedan tin, but real rubber-covered wiring, although the rubber's a little bit lossier than polyethylene, if your frequency is low enough, it's going to work like a charm. And you could use elbows on the ends and go around the corners by using the right kind of a suspension device inside to keep the center conductor a little bit closer to the center as it goes around the corners. But the homebrew coax cable like this, yes, can definitely be done. First, we're going to have the person who said question. Give me your call letters and name, the person with the question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And get back to me one more.
Will do. Go ahead. Question, Eric.
Yes, KJRW and the Tech Man. Good evening, Mel. Dick, this is Anthony, WW2W. Very quickly, in QST, quite a few months ago, there was a contest making an El Cheapo medium power amplifier. One of the winning ones here, or the winning one, is uses IRF Z24N FETs. And these devices are not well known to have a decent amount of high output capacitance. I've noticed in a lot of designs, when you have these transformers using these ferrites, either beads, cores, you know, whatever, you have like one or two turns going to 5, 8 turns, whatever. But I notice on each side, they seem to put a willy-nilly amount of high capacitance, and they're not clear on a lot of these articles, and they don't give you an exact amount, and probably they probably don't really want you to resonate it, but I'm guessing they want you to cancel out part of the inductance at the input and also the output. I noticed there's a low-pass filter. It should be symmetrical, but next to the transforming ferrite, it should be 470, but instead it's 680. So they seem to be trying to cancel out some of the inductance, and I don't even see rule of thumb with respect to doing this. What do you think, KTYRWWW2W?
Yeah, it looks like I've created some confusion here, Anthony. I didn't make it clear that there's a particular subject on the floor that we're discussing, and I thought you were asking a question on that particular subject or making a comment on that subject. You're opening up a brand new question, and that's not allowed at this time. I'll put you on the list. In fact, you climbed above the guy that's ahead of you, if you know what I mean. So I didn't make it clear. Sorry about that, Anthony. John, I know you wanted to make a comment on the subject on the floor, which is this coaxial, homemade coaxial cable. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Mel, welcome back. Glad to hear you in there. Dick, what Mel was talking about, we actually had to build a device like that for a generator coupling 320 megahertz. We did use a piece of half-inch EMT and pitfalls, and we threaded them on like pearls, like one every, I guess it was every 8-10 inches, pulled it through the pipe. The pipe was about 3.5 feet long, and the pitfalls at the end were glued, and the wire was glued to that, pulled tight, worked perfectly. And Mel's right, that'll work fine. Back to you, Dick.
Wow, half-inch EMT tubing is what I think you said you used. Those pitfalls you're describing sound like they're rather large in diameter. Where did you get those pitfalls? What made you decide to build this homebrew cable? Is it because you need a much higher than normal voltage rating? What was your motivation on this one, John? Interesting sounding project. And was that while you were doing some of your Navy service? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, it was a military piece of equipment, and we had to go through two floors, two levels of flooring, which are about 6 inches apart, and they were deck material, like Q-deck with a steel plate on it. And there was a generator in the lower floor, which operated a piece of equipment above, and that was the impetus for doing this. The piece that was in there was hit with a high-low and broken, and it could not be obtained. And it looked like a pipe that had little spiders in it, like speaker spiders, to keep it centered. And, of course, we couldn't get those. And we just got the pit balls, which happened to fit almost perfectly in the EMT. It worked out like a charm.
And once again, John, how many volts or how many watts at what frequency were you shoving through this homebrew pit ball coax cable? And when it comes to the guys doing homebrewing, boy, you're giving some of them some real good ideas. Just like whenever I'm in a rural area, an agrarian area, and I go into their local hardware store, if you use your microwave eye, EYE, and you look at the hardware that's available there, you'd be amazed how many ways you can find of reapplying it. So once again, how many watts, how many volts? And yes, you couldn't find the replacement. You'll probably have to see at the time. And so what was really going through there, that final product of yours? Over to you, John.
Well, the 320 megahertz generator that was down below went into a what they called a high-power amplifier, and it was about 400 watts, and that went up into the second floor area in the CIC room, well, like a CIC room. And another thing, too, we could have bent the pipe because we made some tests by putting offsets in the pipe to try to clear something, and we wound up not doing that. Even though it did work and it was clear, we wound up getting the welders to just burn a hole so we could go up straight and work really well. So anybody who's thinking of doing it, give it a try. Now, on a 10-foot length, I guess you could do it on a 10-foot length, too. Just a little more patience.
Absolutely. And if you use one of these electrician's hickey, as they call it, one of these pipe benders, which has got a fancy U-shaped channel to it, so it properly supports the tubing while it's bending it, so it doesn't become elliptical, you could have gone, as long as you've got close enough spacings of your pith balls, that would have gone around corners. What was the diameter of those pith balls, and where did they come from? Or did you take great big sheets of foam of some kind and homebrew those? To find the pitfalls that big in diameter strikes me a bit unusual. Is that some normal stocked equipment on a Navy ship? Over to you, John.
This was actually in a building. It wasn't on ship. They were stocked pitfalls, and they were actually pith, like a pith helmet is made out of. I don't know where they acquired them, but they were readily available. If I'm not mistaken, they were the finish plug for like wine bottles. After the cork went in on the, before they put the seal cap on it, they put these pith balls on it, and they almost went down the pipe with no friction, just enough drag. So if you put a dot of glue on them, when you positioned it, they stayed perfectly right in place. We didn't have to do anything to them except push the wires through them.
John, were you the crafty guy who came up with that method of home brewing that particular pithball coax cable? Very crafty. Were you the guy that did that, John?
Yeah, Dick, but it was sort of like we had no other choice. And a young fellow I was working with and I, we worked on it, and it took us about an hour to figure it out and how to do it. And I had done something like that before, but it wasn't for that type of use, and it had worked out. We were trying to center a pin. It was like a needle valve in an extended tube, and I had used that then, and that's what made me think of it. So, and it worked fine.
The ham radio philosophy is that you take whatever is available, use it in crafty ways, and you can do some brand new things. Were some of the guys that work with you ham radio operators, is that where that craftiness was coming from, John?
We didn't even have a radio operator around when we were doing this. The fellow I was working with was a, I forget what they call him. Well, he did special work on diesel engines. He was very talented, a good machinist beside, and it's wonderful to work with somebody that has talent like that.
Sounds like an exciting crew to work with. Hey, Mel, I wonder if any of the guys in Brooklyn have ever built homebrew coax cable. You guys have built all kinds of things, but I don't think you've gone quite that far. I bet you wound your own transformers, but building your own coax? Let's find out. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Never went that far, at least personally. The only thing I've got here, of course, was on the loop, the poor loop, when it was in existence, before the storm took it out. With, you know, open wire feeders. Made a number of open wire feeders, homebrew open wire feeders by using, you know, anything. As spread as whatever I found, piece of plastic, Lenny saw, so that's about it. But making my own coax, I never even thought of it, considered it. Like I say, I had this guy here today with his son, and very nice people. They came and took the whole lab, the whole, broke my heart to see all that test equipment go, but my situation, I don't, just a little bit more. You know, to relieve, so they're doing a little bit more for me to relieve my poor daughter in the future situation occurs, to have to dispose of some of the stuff. But one of the pieces of equipment, some of it, I didn't remember what the heck it was. One was a Hewlett Packard, I remember, piece that he took called a CWT amplifier. I don't remember what the heck it was. I was just curious, Dick, over.
Hey, Yuva. You've hit one of my favorite words, TWT, Traveling Wave Tube. oh, I can't think of the name of a man in the late 30s who invented the concept. The Varian brothers, who used to work for Sperry Gyroscope Company and eventually went over to California, they, for some reason, they became unhappy on the East Coast with the Sperry Company, and the Varian brothers opened up their own company called Varian, and they went further with the development of this tube. Let me drop. The magic of a vacuum tube called traveling wave tube is that you focus a beam of electrons with external magnets and high voltage, very similar to what you do with the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube. So you've got a narrow beam of electrons, and around that beam of electrons, you've got this helical wound piece of wire. Lots of turns, lots of length to it. You feed a signal into the input end close to the cathode. The signal going down the helix interacts with the electrons flowing down the center, speeds them up and slows them down cyclically, and by the time the beam gets down to the far end, the electrons have now formed themselves into bundles, into bunches, and those bunches of electrons going out the last few turns of that helix induce a great big signal into the helix. The bottom line is that the traveling wave tube, when properly used, can easily have 25, 35, 45 decibels of gain in one single vacuum tube. And the tube itself, with good design, can cover approximately an octave of frequency. You could build easily a traveling wave tube that goes from 8 to 16 gigahertz inclusive. And some of those traveling wave tubes put out numbers of hundreds of watts and thousands of watts. So it gives you a lot of performance in one single stage. It does require some rather exact machining and tuning and whatever to make this all work. But traveling wave tubes, they are magic. Now, there's two classes of traveling wave tubes. Let me drop. Way back in the late 50s, early 60s, where amplification was very difficult to come by at frequencies above, let me pick a number, 400, 500 megacycles, beyond 500 megacycles, in a vacuum tube, getting low noise amplification gain for the front end of a receiver was very difficult. So there were a series of fairly compact traveling wave tubes used for low noise amplifiers, and some of these were around 8 inches long and about 3 inches square. And internally, there was a high-voltage power supply to make this all happen. So there's a class of traveling wave tubes intended for receiver front-end service that go up to a fraction of a watt of power output, but still produce a whole lot of gain. They were, as I said, they did exist in the late 50s, early 60s. The other class of traveling wave tubes are the ones that are made for real transmitting power, 10 watts minimum up to thousands of watts of output at all kinds of frequencies up to at least 18 gigahertz. There are some very exotic ones that go way beyond that. And some of the moonbound skies now on the microwave frequencies are getting a hold of some of these very expensive tubes. Let me drop. One of the exotic tubes that I worked on the B-1B bomber program, was a tube built by Northrop, a so-called pulse-up tube. And it had lots of gain in the upper X-band, Ku-band frequency region, and it had tremendous amounts of power output in the so-called pulse-up mode. That particular traveling wave tube was $110,000 per copy, and that was $1985. So there are some very expensive, very exotic traveling wave tubes, but the theory of operation is a good thing to read about, and some very nice physics goes on in there. So maybe that's sort of what you were looking for, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Was a test instrument. This was a Hewlett-Packard test instrument. I don't remember the number. I looked at it. It's set on a TWT amplifier, 400, Hewlett-Packard 4 something, 400 series something, I remember. I don't remember much about it. But what the heck was a Hewlett-Packard used it for? I mean, as a test instrument, I mean, what was its application? I mean, actually a test traveling wave tube test amplifier? I didn't remember what it's used for, why I had it, where I got it from, because I just was really curious about a few pieces that they took, you know, that I just was wondering, you know, basically what it was all, what they were all about over.
It does sound like you've got a bit of a museum there, Mel. That's a fairly old piece of equipment, by test equipment, in other words, at VHF, UHF frequencies where the TWT starts performing, gain was so difficult to come by in the old days that even though the traveling wave tube was a little bit slanted in its gain versus frequency, you could calibrate it. And so as long as you got gain, you can now take weaker signals and put them into a slotted line for measuring standing wave ratio, put them into other kinds of detector circuits for measuring signal strength, getting you down to the microvolt region, which you couldn't ordinarily do without some amplification. So I'm guessing that that test instrument, its main purpose in life was to take a weak signal, make it stronger so that it would get up to the threshold where you could operate a crystal detector, for instance, a slotted line, for instance, and the fact that there's a slight slant to its gain versus frequency, that can all be calibrated. And with proper design procedures, it is possible to make a traveling wave tube amplifier cover at least one octave and maybe multiple octaves and be essentially flat in gain across all that region. It is possible to do that. And Hewlett-Packard had enough of those guys that really understood how every one of those electrons flowed through their circuit, so to speak, and I guarantee they could design to do that. So you first began your museum in collecting, probably from Cortlandt Street. I'm guessing around 1948 or so is when you started collecting electronic components. Is that roughly true, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
This is K2KEY. This was a laboratory. This was not Cortlandt Street stuff. This was stuff that was bona fide used in labs that were either closing up, going out of business, or cleaning up. So I wound up with these instruments. This was not for basically just for collecting. These were instruments that I actually were using many times, generators and all this kind of stuff. Just that some of it was so unpopular, but came along with most likely my bid when I bought the lab. I wound up, you know, there were 3 dozen pieces of test equipment that they took. And there were things like, one thing I was looking at, I didn't even know I had it, I was looking at it and I said, gee, take it, what the heck, was things like variable phase synthesizer, phase angle voltmeters, and, you know, I had all this kind of stuff, and I had at least, no doubt, was at least 2 dozen pieces of Mueller packet alone to go, and the others was mixed Tektronix, stuff like Keithley, you know, and so on and so forth, Dick. But it was all professional test equipment that was used in the lab, over.
Yeah, Hewlett-Packard is one of the very successful companies in the United States, as is Apple. But Hewlett-Packard, I'm not sure of the exact year, but I've had a guess, I would say around 1945 or so, 47. Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard lived in Palo Alto, California, and the world needed a very wide-tuning, accurate audio oscillator that would go from, let's say, 10 hertz to at least 20 kilohertz, and maybe the later versions went up to multiple megahertz. So Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard came up with a Wien bridge oscillator. And if you look up the word Wien bridge, if you Google the word Wien bridge, W-E-I-N bridge oscillator circuit or tuning circuit or Wien bridge itself, you'll see that there's a kind of a circuit which has got 4 arms to it, and you properly put resistors and capacitors in there and with a stage of amplification, and now you make an extremely exact, very pure sine wave oscillator. So the Model 200 Hewlett-Packard put that company on the map. The garage in Hewlett-Packard in Palo Alto, where they first invented that instrument, is now considered a national shrine. They've made it into a museum, this little old one-car garage where they developed this product, and that eventually became a multi-billion-dollar company as they started adding other pieces of test equipment. I first cut my teeth in electronics in 1958, I guess it was, and by then there were quite a few pieces of Hewlett-Packard test equipment that were available, and it was considered one of the most respected brands in the world at that time. Let me drop. So that little old Model 200 oscillator is really what put them on the map. An amazing story. And so Hewlett-Packard made some extremely good equipment. The only thing they had trouble with in the beginning was their oscilloscopes. Tektronix always made a better oscilloscope throughout the days that I was heavily involved in oscilloscopes versus spectrum analyzers. Spectrum analyzers, though, Hewlett-Packard really set the standard on that one when they came out with their particular very broadband, very flat spectrum analyzer in, let me think, oh, I guess that was somewhere around 1960 or so. They came out with an extremely good spectrum analyzer. No, or was it maybe 1970? And by the time they came out with the Hewlett-Packard 8566 spectrum analyzer, I think that one became very popular around 1983, and so that makes it what? A 28-year-old piece of equipment, and it's still, in many people's mind, an industry standard. It goes from essentially zero to, I think, either 12.4 or 18 gigahertz. Very well-made instrument. So, the next person who was on our list was Matt, KC2YDT. I hope we didn't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Matt. Go right ahead with your question. YDT, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, KC2YDT.
Okay, I know that Len K2IVX wants to know the signal strength. I was getting a S4 signal on the input from a mobile station during that particular sequence. Why don't you repeat your question on that? KC2YDT, K2RIW.
Okay. Basement to the attic of the house, that's another. If you're using it on
432 megacycles versus 80 meters. So what frequency, how many feet, and where's it going, Matt? KC2YDT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. It is going to the stealth antenna outside. I'm using it just on 2 meter and 70 centimeter. Right now I have the RG58, and it's, you know, hidden in the, you know, in the non-visible area on the roof, and goes up to the stealth antenna. And then it goes down through the window, you know, to the unit. And that's I'm using approximately 50 feet of it.
Yep. This is one of those situations where you pay your money and you take your choice, so to speak, Matt. RG58 on 432 is something in the vicinity of 14 decibels of loss per 100 feet. So you got 50 feet to go, you're going to lose a good 7 decibels of gain. That's, 7 decibels of gain is about a 5 to 1. If you put if you put 50 watts into one end, you get 10 watts out of the other end on 432 megacycles with 50 feet of RG58. If you used RG8 instead on 432, where the loss is around 4.5 dB per 100 feet, 50 feet of that is going to give you a little over 2 dB of loss. And so now you put 50 watts into one end on that one, and you're going to get 35 watts out of the other end. So the RG58 on 432 is going to give you considerably lower loss than RG58, but it's 2 or 3 times bigger in diameter and more visible. So those are the choices you've got. When you go to the good catalogs, they'll tell you exactly what the loss is on each one of those frequencies in decibels per 100 feet. And the nice thing about the decibels per 100 feet is that you use half the number of feet, the insertion loss will be half the number of decibels. And by looking at the right chart, you can find out with this number of decibels of loss, what's the power ratio. 3 dB of loss is a 2 to 1 power ratio. 10 dB of loss is a 10 to 1 power ratio. If your particular coax cable had 10 dB of loss, and you put 100 watts into one end, you're only going to get 10 watts out of the other end if it's got the 10 dB of loss. So larger diameter cables almost always have lower loss, but they've got more weight and more visibility. So those are some of the choices. And now, by way of the charts you can find on the internet, among other places, in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you can decide which of the cables are acceptable for you. And even if you've got a situation where you put 50 watts into one end and you only get 10 watts out of the other end, if it's only the local 450 repeaters you want to go to, and the signal strength happens to be strong enough, that's thoroughly acceptable. The fact that you're getting some extra loss in the cable, as long as you're above threshold to the guy you want to talk to, the repeater you want to talk to, that's very acceptable. So there are people who think that if the system doesn't run 98% efficiency, that it's not worth turning it on. Don't fall into that trap, Matt. KC2YDT, wonder if that helps any. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2YDT. Hey, that helps on, you know, what's better than that. But as far as winter-wise, you know, because again, keep in mind, I've never had a cable, you know, running outside of the house during winter. That really doesn't affect anything. You know, they're both pretty much same sturdiness and all that. You know, it's just the loss of the actual cable, correct?
Well, there's a yes and a no to that one, Matt. When it comes to pure physical strength, RG58 is quite a bit stronger. You could, with the right kind of a connector on the end of a piece of RG58, it's possible you might be able to hang most of your weight from it, your body weight, if you know what I mean. RG58, no way in hell. So the larger diameter cable, if you buy a good brand that's got a lot of braiding on the outside, you know, high-grade coverage. It's got a lot of strength if the connector is properly installed. So if you've got to drape the cable over a long distance where it's going to hang free, the RG58 could take a lot more than the RG... the RG8 can take a lot more than the RG58, the smaller diameter cable. So, and how much physical strength it's got, you go to the right catalog, I'm relatively sure you can find that one also, Matt. When it comes to weatherproofing the end, so that water doesn't get into the cable, there's not much difference between RG58 and RG8 in either case. You'd like to not get water into it. Real RG8 cable with solid polyethylene insulation is very forgiving when it comes to water, whereas the lower loss foam filled versions are not so forgiving. You've got to do a much better job of weatherproofing and wrapping rubber tape on the ends and whatever, because if water starts crawling down the foam, you can get quite a bit of loss, particularly on 2 meters and above. So these are some more of the things you've got to consider as far as beauty, strength, loss, and so on. And maybe you might even want to paint the cable the right color so it matches the woodwork that's on the building. KC2IDT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Thanks again for that. And I think I'll probably end up just switching it over to the RG8 and just doing a little bit of artsy stuff to the wire so it's not that visible. Because again, it's, as long as it's on the roof portion, it's not on the sides of the house where it has to go down, where I'm concerned with. So that's one of the pluses I have. Okay, so it looks like I have a little bit of work to do, so I'll definitely get on that before the first frost comes. Thanks again. KC2YDT, back to Matt.
Question, WS2N. Paul recognized. And Matt, as you proceed with that project, check in periodically and let us know how it goes. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, same topic. Lately I've been using heat shrink tubing on any of the PL259 connectors, outdoors, after you put everything on. Before you do that, I slide a piece of heat shrink tubing on, and then I'll slide that over the silver body and heat that up, instead of just using black tape. It looks really good. I wonder what you think about that. Long term, will the heat shrink tubing, dry rot over time or whatever? That's number one. And number two, how about using silicone grease on the threads of the PL2? You put them on the SO239 connectors and put the PL259 right on that. I haven't tried that yet. I was thinking about that. What do you think about silicone grease, by the way, which is not easy to get? I finally found a place where I can get it. Back to you, Dick.
KB2MAR. KB2MAR, you got a subject on this particular, a comment on this particular subject? And start over with your name, sir.
Name here is Gabe, and it's the stuff that they use to waterproof RF PL259 connector. It's called, believe it or not, it's called the stuff called stuff. AES sells it. It's in a little 3-ounce tube. What you do is you fill the PL259 connector all the way to the top, and what you do is you thread the connector on to the SO239, and as you tie in it, the chemical fills in the voids of the threads, and it'll waterproof the whole thing. And of course, you want to put you want to use the heat shrink tube on the outside of the connector or the electrical tape. KB2MAR, back to net.
Yeah, thank you for that information, Gabe. And so AES is still selling the stuff. If you Google the word stuff, STUFF, it's not easy to find. And so AES is selling it. Do you happen to know the brand name of the company that makes stuff, Gabe? Go ahead.
That's a good question. I have it upstairs. For me to find that little tube, it's like a 2-3 ounce tube. good luck to me. I don't know if I can find it. Maybe I can find it later on. I'll give you the name of the company on the air later on, maybe. I don't know. Let's see. I have to find where that is. Back to you.
Gabe, you don't have to turn the world upside down, but if you do find it, either tonight or next week, let us know, because the brand name is a little bit obscure, not easy to find. But the fact that AES sells it is good. And what I think that stuff is, the word stuff, it's a kind of a white-looking grease in a small tube, and I think it is foamed up, silicone grease or something like that. It's foamed up, in other words, it's got a lot of air to it, but it seals up all of the spaces where there normally would be air inside the conductor, inside the connector. Therefore, it displaces water. It fills up the space where water would normally go. When it comes to the black heat shrink tubing, I think an outdoor ultraviolet exposure, that stuff is extremely good. I think it lasts for lots of years, Paul. That's the good news. Let me drop. And if you're lucky enough to find it, they make various versions of heat shrink tubing that have a goo inside, which really does a good job of sealing. But just simply putting on black heat shrink tubing, it helps. There's a problem. The back end of the connector, if it's, for instance, either a type N or RG, or BNC or type N connector, depending on whether you're using RG58 or RG8 cable, there still is a significant change in diameter between the back end of the connector and the beginning of the coax cable outer conductor. There's a fairly big jump in diameter. Therefore, no matter what you put there in the form of heat shrink tubing or electrical tape, you end up with an airspace at that transition. Ordinarily, the airspace you could ignore, but when it comes to outdoor exposure, you have to consider every airspace is a power piston. By that I mean, when you go from a hot day to a cold day, that very innocent-looking chunk of air that's in that airspace will expand and contract. So if you get a real mil-spec hot day, the sun is beating down, and the connector is sitting at 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and a sudden rain comes along, and now you've got water on the outside of the system, and you get sudden cooling, and the air inside is contracting, that air inside contracting will suck in water. So therefore, you have to do something to try to fill up those airspaces. You can either very skillfully wind the tape in that area to increase the diameter and make it a tapered diameter of the coax cable right where the connector is so that there's not enough of a transition. I get around that with my outdoor connectors by... I fill up that airspace with... what the heck do they call this stuff? Tar. It's a kind of a tar substance you can buy in Home Depot. I can't think of the name of it right now. Window sealing, the stuff that the, it's very similar to the stuff they use for sealing automobile windows, but this,
RTV compound?
RTV compound? Well, yeah, that's the stuff in the tube. I'm talking about the black or greenish brick of stuff. Industrially, it's called monkey blank.
K4NBC.
Mortite.
Mortite, maybe it's one brand. K4NBC, you probably know. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, in automotive supply, it's called dum-dum. It's like a plastic putty, black, never hardens, weatherproof, submersible, all that kind of stuff. And it's also, Andrew calls it coax seal.
K2KE1.
Well recognized, and thank you, Bob. Yeah, duck seal is the word I was looking for. Duck, D-U-C-T, seal is one of the brand names. You go to Radio Shack, not Radio Shack, you go to Home Depot or Lowe's, and you ask for duck seal. You get this black of material. Coax seal is another brand name, and it does an extremely good job. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
No, I have a way of putting a 239, an SO239 connector on, that even before you solder it, you couldn't pull the connector off, Dick, over.
Now give us some words on that. Sounds awfully good.
Okay, if you look on an SO239, you notice there's a thread inside the barrel, the tail end of it, that you can either put an adapter in there to use, the ARG 58 or whatever, Now, if you take your coax and you get a threading guide, now what the heck thread is? 3/8-24. You take a 3/8-24 threading guide, you cut the coax so that the piece will be able to, you actually will put a thread on the polyethylene jacket. You're actually going to, with a sharp, good threading guide, 3/8-24, will actually be able to put a thread on it. You then screw it on to the 239 will actually then screw on, you know, and it will be so strong you couldn't pull it off, Dick. Over.
KB2MAR. That's a very good one, Mel. Gabe, go ahead.
Okay, I found the tube. The name of the actual compound is called dielectric waterproofing filler for coax connectors. It's with Teflon also. And they also call it stuff. And the actual company who makes it is from Cross Devices in Cautauqua, New York, Cutchogue. Back to you.
So Cross Devices, Cross Devices in Cutchogue, is that what you're saying? Gabe, go ahead.
West out.
Okay, Cutchogue is a town on the eastern chunk of Long Island on the North Fork, one of those Indian names. And so Cross Devices makes this dielectric water proofing material, and very nicely stuffed. Now, my favorite way of weatherproofing a connector is to put this duct seal material on the outside of the coax cable on the back end of the connector so that the transition as you go between the larger diameter of the type N or UG the type N connector or PL259 connector, that larger diameter, I fill up the space so that there's a taper between the connector and the diameter of the coax cable. Then I wrap black electrical tape on top of that, or you could use your heat sink shrink tubing. But the thing you want to avoid most is an airspace. By putting the duct seal in there, I avoid that airspace, which becomes a power piston, which will suck in water on a hot summer day when it gets hit with rain. So the combinations now I for instance do not like crimp connectors outdoors. I spend the extra 10 minutes really installing a type N connector. It's a bit of a pain to properly comb out the braid and really put the collet on there and whatever. But when you do it correctly and you do a good job of weatherproofing the connector in the ways that we're talking about, that connector will serve you for an easy 10 years outdoors. Whereas these crimp connectors, I don't think I would trust it for more than a couple of months, giving you good connection and good weatherproofing. That's an opinion. Indoors, crimp connectors, maybe they're okay, but outdoors, I don't trust them. And let me drop. One of the places where you really think that a crimp connector would be okay is on semi-rigid coax cable. UT-141, uniform tubes, number 141 type coaxial cable, where the outer conductor really is about an 1/8-inch diameter copper tubing, Teflon center conductor insulation, and silver-plated center conductor. A crimp connector on that, a SMA-type crimp connector, looks beautiful. But you build a bunch of those and you do a salt spray test in an environmental testing chamber, and a few days later you find out that a certain percentage of them are not giving you very good performance on a standing wave ratio test, a network analyzer. So I don't like crimp connectors. Another place where I wouldn't trust a crimp connector is on the jumper cables that are on the cavity filter that's used for the duplexing filter for a repeater. I would not trust crimp connectors there. I've seen too many cases where you get funny scratching noises on the repeater, a kind of desensitization, and you walk over there and you wiggle the coax cable and you hear the scratching noises coming and going because of the micro-ohms of change in conductivity that exists underneath the crimp connector in that particular very critical location. So weatherproofing and getting rid of air is the main thing I think you've got to worry about, Paul. WS2N, the guy who started the question, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe you should start us with the space report, too. You've got it, Paul.
Very good. Yeah, the question was based on the previous topic, and
really brought that to mind. Yeah, okay, you know, I see the silicone grease. It's like it's very similar stuff. I could probably get away with that. But I see all these other products. They look a lot better. I do have a lot of duct seal. I've used that before, Dick, and then I'll put the tape around that. Like what you said, I've got a whole ton of that duct seal. So I think I have a couple of rolls of it. As far as the widening of the outer jacket, you know, I've done it before by putting a small piece of heat shrink tubing on it, and that brings up the diameter a little bit, you know. I've done that. And recently with these digital converters on the YEP connectors, I had these screw, I'm not crazy about them, but the screw type of F connectors, and you know, they were meant for RG59, and I had RG58 cable. Let me drop it. So the one cable was smaller, and you put the connector on, and it really didn't have a good fit. Well, to make the outer jacket thicker, again, I used heat shrink tubing. Made that thick, you know, you can make that as thick as you want, and then when you screw that thing on, it, the connector thinks it's screwing itself onto a piece of RG58, you know, instead of a smaller diameter, you know what I mean, Dick? All right, I'll give you the space report.
Go right ahead, Bob Paul.
Very good, Dick. Just really one topic. Just the other day, they had this excellent show on Nova, and Nova is always on Channel 13 or 21, and it was called Life Beyond Earth. I wonder if you saw this, Dick. It's 2 hours, and if you missed it, I'll give you the time when it's on again.
Yes, I did see it, Paul. I knew you were going to give a space report for 2 minutes, and you caught me running to the kitchen for something. That two-hour show on life outside of the normal solar system, in other words, this Mars Science Laboratory, the so-called Curiosity that's going to be launched in the next month or so, it's looking for the remnants of life on Mars. The Kepler mission is the one that's looking for all of those exoplanets. There's a whole lot of research right now going on with NASA looking for life in other places. Right now, we've only got a cross-section of one. We got one case of one particular planet, one particular solar system where life formed. And this two-hour, very well-done NOVA program. Each hour is a slightly different slant on that subject of searching for life on each of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Mars and other solar systems, other star systems. We really want to find out that we're not alone. The strongest evidence...
I'll finish it up, Dick. You want to take a break? No problem.
Yeah, the strongest evidence we've got is that you take the right raw materials, you put them into a flask, you pass a spark through it, you start building up the amino acids, and there's a lot of evidence that if the conditions are right and the time is long enough, life will form every time. The evidence we've got is that life is kind of natural, and part of this program shows you the extreme places where life can live, under the ice of the North Pole and the South Pole, places where it's extremely hot, and you don't even need sunlight. The usual ingredients for life, according to the program, is you have to have some kind of a fluid medium like water, you have to have a source of energy, and you have to have a mixing process. Well, the hot vents that you have in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, life forms there with no sunlight. Ordinarily, you need a source of energy like sunlight, the right raw ingredients, you know, nutrients, and some kind of a fluid medium so that everything gets churned up and life will form. And so here we are very busily looking for all of those planets that we're starting to discover, thousands of them by way of the Kepler project, thousands of planets around other stars, and we're going to start measuring very carefully how many of those planets live in the Goldilocks zone, you know, not too close to the star so that they're too hot, not too far away so that they're too cold, and hopefully we'll eventually find evidence of them having water, and the water that's on this planet looks like it came from the comets. So go ahead and tell us more about that, and also tell us when that program's going to be repeated, Paul. Very well done program by my standards. And there's a couple of other very good NOVA programs I've seen in advertisement coming up. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW.
Okay, anybody that listens to this, that, yeah, would get a real appreciation of that show. I didn't know it was going to be on, and sure enough, it did come on, and I recorded it, of course, and it, if I knew this last week, I would have made the announcement, so you know, I tell you, out of all the shows, Discovery and this and that, Nova always does the best, in my opinion. Life Beyond Earth, it was done actually in 2 one-hour shows. So, you know, maybe it was meant to be separated by a week, but they put on one right after the other. And the next time it will be on will actually be at right after this net at 3:30 in the morning, a couple of hours after the net. So you need a DVR, you need a VCR or a DVD, or you have to really like to stay up very late. So actually, Monday at 3:30 in the morning to 5:30 in the morning, so 2 hours, 3:30 to 5:30 on Channel 13. It will be on later on, you know, I think the 27th or whatever, but you could always check the programming. But the next show would be actually Monday morning at 3:30. Let me drop it. And I got a kick out of the show is they talked about quite a few of the missions that, you know, robotic missions that we've talked about here on the net over the years. And, you know, I mean, we go into a lot more detail over each mission, but, I mean, they had a good overview. And of course, the real pictures and the animations are always terrific. They covered the Messenger program briefly, dealing with Mercury, which Messenger is now in orbit. We talked about that extensively. Launch all the way to orbit. They covered Spirit and Opportunity briefly, but they did bring it up. They covered Curiosity a little bit more. Spirit and Opportunity have been riding around on Mars since, what, 2004 in January. They landed a couple of weeks apart. One of them is still operating. Spirit is not. And then they did cover Curiosity, which originally was going to go up in August. And they pushed that back to November, now end of December. Let me drop it. Later that will go into the atmosphere of Mars, and that will really do one heck of a job. That has instruments on board that will detect whether or not there was real life. Opportunity and Spirit didn't have that capability. This one does. That it's the size of a very small car compared to the size of a small golf cart that Opportunity and Spirit were. So it's probably five times bigger, five times heavier than Spirit. Opportunity. Another one that they covered pretty good, which was Stardust. And that went out to the comet Belt. And that was, they showed that, when we dropped West when they showed that it finally bought, you know, after years of going out to this comet, bringing the sample return, they picked it up in this aerogel type of catches mitt, which they really didn't cover, but we did on the net. Picked it up, basically picked up the atmosphere of this comet and brought it back, and they analyzed it over time. They figured out that there were amino acids on board. Dick mentioned before you need a couple of things, water and energy, and one of the things you need is some kind of carbon or amino acids. It's really good because that's the basis of life. Not a biologist, but I understand that that's what you need. They covered Galileo, the one that went to Jupiter, which we did on the net extensively. That thing has, of course, since been deorbited into the planet, because they didn't want to contaminate the moon. That thing was never made or designed to go anywhere, you know, touch the moon. So it didn't have, it wasn't as sterile as they would like it to be. So when the